This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
He crept into his bed where Shirley was asleep, and he tried to have sex with her. And she calmly said, quote, "Not tonight, sweetheart," which was not the answer that Richard wanted to hear. And it's not the one he would expect it, and it's not the one he would allow. And this is the point where, by the way, in Richard's mind, Shirley goes from being a pure Madonna to a, quote, "dirty whore."
Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
What is happening, crime crew? Welcome to episode 82 of Murder Unscripted, podcast that breaks down the barrier between true crime fan and true crime creator. I'm Ed Hydock here with my elf on the shelf, Melissa Spivey.
Is that because I'm like creepy and I'm always watching?
Yeah, you're always at my house. You're in different places. It's weird.
It's true. Every time you turn around. Well, like 2 weeks ago, you said I was like herpes. So, because I'm always there. So
you're just,
I'd rather be the elf on the shelf.
There you are in the kitchen. Like, where did you get here? Well, y'all, if this is your first time listening, welcome. And secondly, the format of our show is each month we pick a new theme. Could be a specific kind of forensics. It could be a way that people were murdered. So what we do then is every week of that month, we will pick a different case that fits into that theme. And then in the fourth week, we have a special guest that somehow ties into one of those cases. We are currently in week three of December, which means we are in our recap block. It's what we call every December, a yearly recap. It's kind of lame, actually, now that I think about it. What a cheesy theme name. Yeah, we'll have to work on that. But in week three, we're going to be telling you one more case. And then we almost had a special guest.
Yeah, should we like tell everyone what happened with our special guest for this month? First of all, we don't generally have a guest in December, kind of for this exact reason.
Exactly.
The holidays
it's hard.
And everything. People are busy.
People are busy and it's tough to coordinate. So long story short, we did have a guest. And this is why in TV, we do not count on people until they're in the chair.
That's how I feel about death sentences. Not until they're in the chair.
The electric chair. Good one. Well, so we got thrown a wrench. We did tease a guest. So I will tell you anyway, just in case things do work out down the road. So I'm sure many of you have watched the Netflix series Monster, the Ed Gein story. It came out a few months ago and it got great reviews. But in episode 8 of that series, another famous killer is highlighted, and that killer is Richard Speck. So what happened is we were reached out to by the people for a man named Tobias Jelinek, and he was the guy who played Richard Speck in the Netflix series. And you also may know him as Jay from Hocus Pocus, the Halloween
like
movie.
Like everyone's favorite Halloween movie.
Literally a few days ago, they basically said, oh, we have a conflict. We were supposed to record the other night. So we're pivoting with the hope that Tobias can join us down the road, because it would be interesting. We haven't talked to like a true crime actor yet. But I will tell you that we do have a pretty incredible backup guest lined up. And this is going to air on December 30th. I cannot think of a better guest to help ring in the new year. So I will leave it at that. And with that being said, Melissa, do you want to kick us off?
Sure do. Well, before you get into it, just a quick reminder to please like, rate, review, and subscribe. It is a huge help to us and the show. And another reminder, our Patreon will be rolling out in January. So yes, it will. Get excited for that. But now, without further ado, let's get into today's case. And Richard Speck, well, he is definitely a complete monster. He really did change things in kind of like how people thought about murderers and why people killed.
So let's get into this case. And I will mention that it is a two-parter. And I'm sorry to hit you guys with two-parters in December, but that's just the way it worked out. And again, this two-parter was because of Tobias Jelinek, but doesn't mean we still can't tell you the story, even though we don't have Tobias anymore. Quite all right.
So we had a really good source while we were writing this. We actually used a book called The Townhouse Massacre, The Unforgettable Crimes of Richard Speck. And it went into great detail. It was written by Ryan Green, and I actually had the book and the audiobook. So you can get it kind of whatever platform you're into.
Those are my favorite sources because authors have done all the legwork. They put in an incredible amount of research to get these done. So if you ever have the chance to read a book on a case, that is the way to go. So it's the early morning of July 14th, 1966, and we're on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. So a student nurse named Judy Dykton groans as she hears her alarm going off. It's 5 a.m., and she was waking up early to get some last-minute studying in because she had a big exam later that day and definitely needed a little extra cram session.
Been there.
Yeah, right? Well, Judy turns her alarm off. She got out of bed, and it had been incredibly hot and humid lately, so Judy slept with a fan on. And the moment she turns this fan off, she hears this piercing shriek. And initially, she thinks maybe it's an animal wailing in the distance, like maybe a fox or something in the field. She kind of brushes it off and begins gathering some dirty laundry. And she carries it downstairs to the washer and starts the load. And she shuffles back to her room and is just about to crack her textbook open when she hears another scream. And this time, she cannot ignore it because it was blood-curdling.
Oof.
Right? So Judy opens her window and she hears the words, "Oh my God, they're all dead." Can you imagine?
No. Oh my God.
God. So she looks where the screams are coming from, and right there across the street from her was this friend and fellow student named Corazon Cora Amora. She was on the second floor ledge, completely frantic and screaming, "Oh my God, they're all dead." So Judy snatches her bathrobe and she hightails it down the stairs, out the door, and across the street to 2319 100th Street. And she had no idea, obviously, what Cora was talking about. So she runs up, she opens the door, only to see a chaotic, violent, and bloody crime scene. Oh. It's a scene that the coroner would later declare the crime of the century.
That's a big statement to make.
That sure is. Mm-hmm. Well, because two other pods recently covered Speck, and I would assume that's because of the Netflix series, just like we were going to do. We're going to tell it a little differently. So instead of letting the crimes play out and then finding out who it is, we're going to kind of go back to the very beginning, which is December 6th, 1941. And that's the day Richard Benjamin Speck was born. And we're just going to tell you how we got here. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the catalyst for World War II, would happen just a few hours after this guy was born. Isn't that nuts?
That's pretty wild. Like, it definitely seems that December 7th might not be the only day that would live in infamy.
Fair statement. Absolutely.
It's December 7th today, which is really weird.
That is weird. Well, Richard was the seventh of eight children, and his sister Carolyn would come along 2 years after Richard was born. And I'm not sure if Richard and Carolyn were accidents, surprises, whatever, but they were significantly younger than the first six children. However, unplanned or not, Mary was a devoted mother. Maybe a little too devoted, though, now that I think about it, because by the time Richard was born, it was like this mother was already experiencing empty nest syndrome. You know, like, her children were growing up, some of them were out of the house, and the others didn't really need her as much at that point, which resulted in her being overly protective, overbearing, like kind of obsessed with Richard and Carolyn, which...
That's tough, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they were her babies, and she wanted them to remain her babies. And the only thing Mary loved as much as her children was her faith. She was a very devout and very conservative Protestant Christian. She made it clear to all her children that they were expected to live their lives according to strict religious morals. She was also a complete teetotaler. Like, she did not approve of alcohol one bit. And Mary's husband and the children's father, Benjamin Speck, was the same. He was also very religious, anti-alcohol. But with the religion, he was definitely not as, like, in-your-face as Mary was. Benjamin wasn't really in-your-face about anything, to be honest. I mean, he was this quiet and stoic guy, just kind of went along for the ride. And that's, I get it, man. Guy after my own heart. But he didn't seem to mind that his and Mary's relationship was very unorthodox for the time. And I say that because Mary was clearly the alpha of the Speck household. Mm-hmm. The one societal norm that they did follow was that Benjamin worked while Mary raised the children. And it wasn't until Richard was born that Benjamin began getting more involved with his children. And because of this, Richard was very close to his father. As a child, he idolized Benjamin. But we will see that Richard has some mommy issues because he really resented this overbearing presence in his life. She was the OG, like, helicopter mom, micromanaging everything that Richard and Carolyn did, which was another reason he gravitated more toward his dad, which I can understand that, especially in those growing years. Well, Benjamin was a hard worker, but he did struggle to keep up with the expenses that came with a family of 10. They weren't exactly poverty-stricken, but they were on the lower end of the income scale. And Benjamin had spent most of his adult life working incredibly intense labor jobs. He'd worked on a farm, he was a logger for a time, and at the current moment, he was working at a manufacturing plant. So this was a blue-collar dude trying to hold it together. Mm-hmm. So one day, when Richard was about 6 years old, Benjamin had a heart attack while at work. Even though he was rushed to the hospital, the medical team was unable to restart his heart, and Benjamin Speck was dead. And as we will see, Richard's ability to basically deal with life and the world was dead as well. So there's a passage in the book that we were talking about that says, quote, "The children had lost their father, Mary had lost her husband, and Richard lost his whole world," end quote. That's pretty powerful. I mean, that's pretty final. And remember, this was the mid-40s, so mental health was not exactly at the forefront of society's interests. And something that especially wasn't happening was like counseling or therapy for children. I can only imagine. Yeah. I mean, I obviously wasn't alive back then, but from what I've heard, that wasn't a thing. And Richard, he never received any sort of grief counseling following his dad's death. And I feel like this was the beginning of the end for Richard Speck because he spent the next few years becoming more and more withdrawn from the world. He'd always been a painfully shy and quiet kid, but Benjamin's death just exacerbated that. Mm-hmm. However, let's get one thing straight, though. His extreme antisocial behavior had started long before Benjamin's death.
Yeah.
So the year prior, when Richard was about 5 years old, his teacher started noticing that he was struggling to see the chalkboard, even when he was in the front row. So Mary and Benjamin got little Richard fitted for glasses. And on today's edition of Kids Are Assholes, the children in school were basically bullying him for wearing glasses, which severely impacted his self-esteem. And at the time, teachers would consider him a kind boy who needed some extra help. But again, this would change after Benjamin died. So Richard became even more antisocial, more self-isolated. It seemed like the only person he could really rely on was his younger sister, Carolyn. And in school, Richard was really struggling. Like, he definitely had some learning difficulties working against him, but I think a lot of it, too, was this debilitating shyness that he had. He was so shy and had such low self-esteem that he couldn't even bring himself to speak in front of the class. So when the teacher would make him do the thing where we all had to stand up and, like, read things in front of our classmates, and Richard was seething. I mean, this is where he realized that he hated women. He blamed his teacher for embarrassing him. According to Richard, quote, "That damn teacher was a whore," end quote. Wow.
That is quite a leap to go from being mad at your teacher and mom so you hate all women. And it's also incredibly early in life to have that much hate already inside you.
Isn't that wild? Like, you're taught that.
A lot.
Yeah, you don't know that. So it's crazy how it came about. But just a few years after Benjamin's death, Mary began dating again. And Richard was aghast at the thought of his mother being with another man. And we've heard this time and time again. Mm-hmm. So it compounded Richard's belief that all women were whores. And keep in mind, he's declaring that all women were whores at the ripe old age of like 7 or 8, which is crazy insane. He's like the vintage incel.
He really is.
When he was 9, Mary began dating a man named Carl Lindbergh, and Richard's anger grew. And for transparency, Carl was a slimy dude, like think insurance salesman, but like used car salesman slimy. Yeah, that's kind of vibe he gave off. He was smooth. He knew exactly what to say. And Richard hated him immediately. And that hatred grew as he watched his mother and siblings take to Carl. Richard saw this as the ultimate betrayal. Like, they were all trying to replace his father, which in a kid's mind can kind of see it, I guess.
I get that. But I think what's so wild is that he took it as such an insult, like his mother wanted to be with another man, and that's why she was a whore. And it's like, she didn't want Benjamin to die, but at some point, she needed to move on.
Yeah, and kids don't see that. They don't understand yet. Well, one day, Richard and his siblings were instructed to dress in their Sunday best, and they took a train to destinations unknown. Unfortunately for Richard, that final destination was the marriage ceremony of his mom and that goddamn charlatan, Carl Lindbergh. And as we'll see, Richard was right about Carl, but we will get into that later. We'll talk about Carl in a little bit. So Richard was devastated and his angst spread deeper and deeper, like a cancer, until it controlled his thoughts and all of his actions. It definitely did not help when Mary decided that Carl was going to adopt the kids and they were all going to take his last name.
All in the same day.
I know. Isn't that
wild?
That's a lot. Here's your new dad. Oh, you got his last name. Anything else we can throw at you?
Well, there is more.
There's lots more. There's so much more. But basically, like within just a few hours, his beloved father, Benjamin, had been completely erased. He was no longer Richard Speck. He was now Richard Lindbergh.
Ugh.
And at this point, it's when Richard completely gave up. Like he not only gave up on his studies, but just on humanity as a whole.
I mean, can you blame him? Like his entire identity was stolen from him. And like, not to put this on Mary, but clearly she wasn't reading any parenting magazines because I feel like she handled this situation pretty crappy.
I know. And we're sitting here talking about this, like trying to defend a brutal killer, which I hate doing. I mean,
yeah,
we're sitting here trying to dissect his childhood. But all I can say is that he went on to do some atrocious things. Some of this may have been to blame.
And we can feel bad for the child, but we also have to look at how many other children had lives similar and who grew up to be upstanding citizens who never killed anybody.
Exactly. And I know there was a little element in here that you think may have also led to this. So we'll dig into that in just a little bit. So it does get worse, though. So adding to Richard's anger and his depression, right after the wedding, Mary put their home up for sale. And she and Carl moved to Dallas, Texas, where Carl lived. And it was only a few months from the end of the school year, and it was decided that Richard and Carolyn would stay behind in Monmouth, Illinois, with their oldest sister, Sarah, to finish up the school year, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But Richard basically refused to do any schoolwork, and he really should have been held back to repeat the second grade. However, his teachers knew he was struggling with the changes in his life. So they're like, what do we do with this situation? Like, do we come down even harder, or do we just kind of let him slide? And that's what they did. They chose to pass him. And they bid him adieu. So Richard and Carolyn soon joined their mother and Carl in Dallas. So by now, Carl had completely given up on playing the part of the charismatic and charming man that Mary originally fell in love with. Once the ink was dry on the marriage certificate, he let his Mr. Perfect facade slip away, as a lot of men do.
Yeah.
He was chain smoking. He was drunk. He was a criminal. He had a rap sheet that spanned years. Mostly, there were a lot of DUIs, other minor offenses. Oh, and he was an angry drunk, especially toward Richard. So at the beginning, Carl did try to befriend Richard, but the loyalty that Richard felt toward his father would not allow him to even entertain the thought of warming up to Carl. Like, he hated this guy for essentially replacing his father in his mind. And by now, to be honest, Carl didn't give a shit. He didn't want these kids, and he was certainly not going to put up with an angry and defiant Richard. He made decent money, a lot more than Benjamin did, but that was still not enough. The family struggled as Carl drank away the majority of his paycheck. He would come home after work and get completely blotto every day.
It's so sad.
Yeah. Well, Carl began making snide comments about Richard then, and at first it wasn't overly mean or critical, but the words evolved into these cruel jabs laced with just disgust and resentment, which essentially smashed into pieces any amount of self-esteem that Richard had left. So one day when he was about 10 years old, Carl, continuing his derogatory rhetoric toward Richard, took his hatred a step further and made a disparaging mark about Benjamin, his father. Whatever Carl said, no, we don't know exactly what he said, but it set red hot anger surging through Richard's body. And he suddenly began throwing hands right at Carl. And remember, this is a 10-year-old child coming at a grown man. And Carl swats Richard's pathetic, weak little punches away and laughs in the kid's face and then mocked him for being so weak. And this humiliated and enraged Richard. So he grabs this hammer and he swings it at Carl. Similar to the punches, Carl was able to easily swat this hammer away. Unfortunately for Richard, when Carl smacked it, he did it with such force that the hammer came flying back and hit Richard and smashed into his skull. And he immediately crumbled to the ground unconscious. And we've discussed on this show several times, but you, Melissa, especially are a firm believer that childhood head trauma is a huge factor when it comes to the decisions that these murderers make.
Oh my God, yeah. Like if I was making that McDonald triad, I would dump the bedwetting and change it to childhood head trauma. If you go and look at all these killers, so many of them, Gacy, didn't he get hit in the head with a swing?
He did. I can't remember if it was on a playground or at home, but yeah. When Richard came to, Carl was slapping at him and he was covered in his own vomit. It was clear that he now hated Carl more than ever. And according to sources, this is the point when Richard went from being this quiet, angsty little child to being completely unhinged and unable to control his rage. So later, doctors would determine that this blow to the head hit the part of his brain that managed impulse control and emotions. So we know things are not going to end well. Like, the hammer incident was never mentioned again, and Richard lied when Mary asked where the significant bruise on his head came from. He was probably scared at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl was constantly dragging Mary and the kids to new homes, new neighborhoods, and due to his excessive drinking taking a substantial amount from their paycheck, there was always poverty. They were just living in the slums of Dallas. And Richard began spending less and less time at home, and this is when the drugs and the drinking really started. So I mentioned that Carl was an alcoholic, which obviously meant there was no shortage of booze in that Lindbergh house.
Mm-hmm.
So by age 12, Richard had a full-blown addiction to alcohol.
Age 12.
12,
that's
isn't that insane?
Insane.
I know, right? I've heard 12-year-olds, like, trying alcohol, but to be a full-blown mm-hmm. addict by age 12, I guess just because of your environment, the access to the alcohol, the role model that you have,
yeah.
and the anger. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was able to build his tolerance to the point where he could have a couple drinks without even feeling it at age 12. And wow. that obviously meant, as we know, you drink more and more because he liked the way he felt when he was wasted. And it didn't help that ever since this hammer to the head, he was experiencing excruciating headaches. But when he drank, those headaches went away, at least temporarily. He was caught in this vicious cycle where he would drink to get rid of the headaches, but then the alcohol would give him headaches.
He goes through that for, like, most of his life, where he, like, self-medicates with the alcohol to numb the pain, but then alcohol is going to give you a hangover headache as it is. So it's like, you're just kind of delaying the inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, I mean, I know I talk about the head trauma, but let's also consider the effects that this alcohol is having on a 12-year-old's undeveloped brain.
Right. I think it's, what, 25? I may 25? Be making that up. That your brain
no,
is
developed?
No, I
think you're right. I pulled some stats when I knew we were going to talk about Richard Speck, and I got this information from the Hanley Foundation, who, FYI, they state that their mission is to eliminate addiction through prevention, advocacy, treatment, and recovery support. According to this foundation, quote, underage drinking can lead to long-term cognitive impairments affecting memory, attention, and overall cognitive function, end quote. And they go on to talk about how alcohol in a developing brain can cause impaired decision-making, impulsive behavior, and poor judgment, you know, as you get older later in life. And mm-hmm. I mean, if that stuff I just said doesn't scream Richard Speck, I'm not sure what does.
That's true. But at what point does the trauma from the hammer outweigh the alcohol? Like, what is actually the core, the root problem?
I think they played off each other.
I agree with that. I think it's a combination of things.
Yeah.
Well, things definitely got worse for Richard when in 1952, his older brother Robert was killed in a car accident. And this broke Richard even further. You may not have thought that was possible at this point, but he was self-medicating even more with alcohol and now narcotics, both of which were super easy to find in these god-awful neighborhoods that this family was living. So Richard began avoiding his home as much as he possibly could, and he would spend nights wandering the streets in a kind of a drug and alcohol-induced stupor. And at age 13, Richard was arrested for the very first time. On those nights he spent wandering the slums, he would eventually get tired, and instead of going home, he would break into buildings. They were either under construction, maybe it was an abandoned house, whatever. But this was his first arrest, was for trespassing. But it was only the beginning of a lifetime of legal problems. So before the age of 18, Richard had been charged with every misdemeanor in the book, anything that police could make stick. And it got to the point where any time that a crime was committed in the nearby area, police would go to Richard's house because they just kind of assumed he had something to do with it.
That's pretty bad when the cops, like, find something, like, went wrong and they're like, well, better stop at the Speck house or the Lindbergh house.
Yeah. Wild. Well, as Richard grew into his early teens, his opinion of women got worse and way more confusing. Like, he became even more shy around girls in his class and was beginning to notice them developing. His self-esteem was at an all-time low, especially because his face was covered in pimples and boils. And side note, if you look at pictures of Richard Speck, even in his final years, you can see pockmarks
mm-hmm.
that were left behind from that acne. And this just made him even more shy and miserable. And this is something that it does hit kind of close to home for me because I was bullied so hard in the eighth grade. Like, if you look at my skin, I have, like, very tiny pockmarks too because I had awful acne. I played hooky so many times my eighth grade year. Just because of this one asshole in particular, but it was a time when you're desperate for attention, and then all you get is negative attention, especially from girls and stuff, because of your skin. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely an awful time. So I do feel for him in that respect, but that is the point where my empathy ends for him.
Yeah, I feel badly for him in this case, because it's like, he hated even good attention. Mm-hmm. So then when you made it negative and he felt like he was the butt of the joke.
Right.
And I think that that kind of goes back to living with Carl. I think Carl kind of made him the butt of a lot of his jokes. So it was like,
I think so too.
Richard just constantly felt that he had to kind of be on the defense.
Yeah. And like we were just talking, it's a combination of things like the environmental factors, physical trauma, and then all this alcohol abuse. It all adds up. Well, the more introverted Richard became, the less he would do at school, which led to him having to repeat the eighth grade. But by the time he got to high school, he literally failed out with an actual zero. Like, that's hard to do.
That's
like,
not a
single credit was earned. And at the age of 16, he drops out.
Wow.
But things weren't great at home either. Like, his mother was still micromanaging every single move he made. And this is really messed up, but he began having inappropriate feelings toward his sister, Carolyn. Carolyn had always been the one person that would listen to him, that Richard could talk to and not feel like a piece of shit. But now these intrusive thoughts, I think that led to like a love or some kind of lust, like, because maybe she was the one person that was like treating him the way he thought he should be treated.
Right.
And it got real weird and kind of made him withdraw from Carolyn, actually. So this is like the one person he had a connection with. He destroys it.
He is his own worst enemy in every situation.
100%. Well, eventually, Carl begins coming home less and less, spending more time on the road as a traveling salesman. And this was actually good for Richard because he now began coming home because he knew Carl wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Though soon enough, Carl had actually left the family completely and moved to California to ruin some other single mom's life. But this meant that Richard was now the man of the house, and it was up to him to earn the money to support his sister and his mother. So he actually began working at the 7-Up bottling plant. And as we'll see, when Richard wanted to be a good employee, he was actually a good employee. Like, he quickly rose to the top. He was well-respected. He was revered. However, this generally wouldn't last very long because of his drinking and drug use.
Always comes back to that.
Yeah, he could do it if he wanted to. And he let the demons win.
Mm-hmm.
Well, having a job and pretending to be this upstanding citizen did not change that anger that Richard harbored toward his mother. So her marriage to Carl had left Richard with little to no respect for women.
But it's so odd because it's like he loves her, but he hates her at the same time. And I think that that drives his entire life because I think he's so confused about these feelings he has for her.
Yeah. He's conflicted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one night Richard loses his temper and he takes it out on his mom. And this is like where a line gets crossed, I think, because he managed to give her two black eyes and a broken cheekbone. But she never told the police, which I don't get. I think she was, again, protecting him. And we're going to see that come up later as well. She did have to see a doctor, which meant Richard's first documented violence toward a woman was this incident. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, his characterizing of his mother as a whore will change throughout life, which we'll come back to.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, Richard is about 20 years old. It's around 1961, and Richard goes to the Texas State Fair. And besides being at work or hanging out at a bar, the fair was like the only place that Richard would go out in public. It was kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at this fair where he met a woman who would become his first wife. And by woman, we'll say child. So this was Shirley Annette Malone, 15 years old.
Ugh. And
like age 35 to 40, no biggie. 15 to 20, I feel like, is a major biggie.
Big deal. Yeah.
Yeah, right? So Shirley was at the fair with her parents when Richard laid eyes on her. And he thought, what, love at first sight. That was what's happening in his head. Basically, it's the first time a predator laid eyes on his victim. If we're calling it like it is. Well, if you can't tell by now, Richard puts women into two categories. You got Madonna and whore.
Mm-hmm.
There's like no middle ground, like no gray area. His younger sister, Carolyn, definitely a Madonna. His mom, whore. New girlfriend, Shirley, Madonna. Like he liked that she was, quote unquote, perfect and pure.
Gross.
I know. It's very Anthony Allen Shore.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, the two walked around the fair together and were pretty much inseparable after that. And Richard wanted to impress Shirley with his maturity, Mr. Big 20-year-old. So he took her to several bars around town. Great. Take the 15-year-old to a bar.
Yeah. That's how you show that you're mature.
Yeah. And then begin having sex with her on a regular basis. And Richard justifies this by convincing himself that Shirley was pure because it was the alcohol that made her want to have sex.
Isn't that so twisted? Like, she wasn't making the decision. It was the alcohol. So she was still a good person. She was still a Madonna. She was still pure.
And she's 15.
It's just his head not is only just are, so twisted.
Yeah, there's a reason you're not allowed to vote. There's a reason you're not allowed to make adult decisions when you're under 18. And you throw alcohol in something else you're not allowed to do when you're 15.
Yeah.
Like, good Lord. Well, get this. Well, within 3 weeks, Shirley was pregnant.
Oh, good. Now we have a child having a child. This is, yes. I'm sure this is going to end well for everyone involved.
Absolutely. Well, per both of their family wishes, demands, whatever you want to call them, Richard and Shirley had a shotgun wedding, and Shirley moved in with Richard, his mother, and Carolyn. So if Richard wasn't a complete monster, this should have been the best time of his life. He was doing well at work, bringing home actual money. He had this beautiful, albeit very young, wife who worshipped him, mm-hmm. and a family that cared about him, and a baby on the way now. But if you haven't seen the writing on the wall, Richard was his own worst enemy, as you just said earlier. Mm-hmm. Like one night, he came home after work, he crept into his bed where Shirley was asleep, and he tried to have sex with her. And she calmly said, quote, "Not tonight, sweetheart," which was not the answer that Richard wanted to hear. And it's not the one he would expect it, and it's not the one he would allow. So he raped and beat Shirley. And needless to say, things were never the same between them. Like, Shirley absolutely despised Richard, and he made it even worse as he continued to beat and rape her on the daily basis. Shirley was trapped. I mean, there's no other way to say it. She was young, she was pregnant, she was fully dependent on Richard and his family. Oh, and this is the point where, by the way, in Richard's mind, Shirley goes from being a pure Madonna to a, quote, dirty whore. Just
yeah, because
clear.
She got pregnant. She's a whore, right. Never mind right. that it's his kid.
With your child. Like, yeah.
Yeah. He's so twisted.
He really is. Well, and get this. So also, he stopped going to work at this point, and all of that goodwill that he'd built up with his employer was completely gone. Like, his bosses weren't going to accept him where he would stumble in after a week-long bender of alcohol and pills. And he also wouldn't keep in contact with Shirley or the family as he was drinking his way through Texas. At night, he would either sleep in these new construction homes or in the drunk tank of whatever town had the bad luck of playing host to Richard. So on July 5th, 1962, his daughter Robbie Lynn Speck was born, and Shirley gave birth alone. Richard was not there to hold Shirley's hand or meet his own daughter. Why, you ask? Because he was locked up. Yeah, so shortly after Robbie's birth, Richard was in some random Texas town drinking himself silly in a local bar. And at some point, another patron became the focus of Richard's drunken delusions, and we're pretty sure it was a perceived slight of some kind that set Richard off. Like, he got into yet another bar fight, so bad that the other guy landed in the hospital. And Richard was thrown in county jail for 22 days under the charge of disturbing the peace.
Wow.
So when he was finally released, he went home and it was absolutely livid to see that Shirley had left and taken the baby with her. But good for you, Shirley.
Good for
smart
her.
Move.
Yeah.
Yes. Especially being that young and just saying, you know what, I'm not going to tolerate this.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary and Carolyn were the only ones at home, and none of them would tell Richard where Shirley and the baby were. They were pissed, and they were over Richard behaving like a giant man-child.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first time in his life, Richard's actions seemingly affected him. Like, Mary and Carolyn, the two women that he loved the most in this world, were basically on the brink of disowning him.
I kind of wish that they would have disowned him. Like, maybe that could have been the kick in the ass he needed.
It's true. 100% true. But they keep hanging on, and Mary especially, the mom.
Yeah.
Well, Richard made up his mind literally right then and there that he was going to stop drinking. I'm going to get sober. I'm going to get on the straight and narrow. And that would be fantastic if we were at the end of the story right now. But with Richard, nothing is that easy.
Let's just be done right now. And that's the end.
What a great story. Well, he had begged and pleaded for his job back at the bottling plant, but the sincerity didn't last long. Soon enough, he was showing up to work drunk, picking fights with other employees. And that's on the days when he actually showed up. Like, he was just waiting to be fired, which isn't good for a man who needed money to continue pickling his liver.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided he was going to get money another way, by stealing a coworker's check, forging that man's name, and cashing said check. Of course, how else is there to make money?
Obviously.
And in a surprise to no one, Richard was caught and arrested just a few days later. Oh, in those days prior to him being arrested, he also robbed a small grocery store where he got away with a carton of cigarettes, a six-pack of beer, and three whole dollars. I was just wrong a second ago. Apparently, there is another way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
$3.
Yeah.
Well, he was charged and ultimately convicted of fraud and robbery. And at 21 years old, Richard Speck was sentenced to 3 years in prison. And FYI, prior to this, he had been arrested over 40 times. 4-0.
At 21 years old.
Isn't that ridiculous? Like, they
insane.
Were all misdemeanors and small things, but it adds up.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear, I am not defending Richard Speck by any means whatsoever. However, during this whole time, he was still experiencing those debilitating headaches And he thought the only way to manage them was to like drink and self-medicate with narcotics. And as I mentioned earlier, this was just exacerbating his brain injury, making the headaches worse and worse.
Richard Speck is like the epitome of the United States justice system is broken. Like, he should not have been out. I don't care if they were misdemeanors. I don't care what they were. Like, after 40 of them,
40
he should
arrests.
Not have been out walking the streets. He shouldn't have.
What do you need to see in somebody before you say, you know what, enough is enough?
It's ridiculous.
Well, in a throwback to our Daniel Lee Corwin episode, Richard was sent to the Texas State Prison in Huntsville. I'm going to say it again, like, Texas, what is happening down there? Because you got Daniel Corwin, Anthony Allen Shore was down in Houston, now you got Richard Speck.
Yeah, are you guys okay? What is happening down there,
seriously,
guys?
This was an epidemic. Well, Richard actually did well in prison, and we're not talking like model prisoner well, but did well in the sense that he established himself as like an angry man who would beat up the smaller man at the drop of a hat. So like, successful at prisoning, he was. Mm-hmm. And he also found a group of fellow junkie alcoholics, but in a very unexpected move, really, Richard did not take part. He had something that made him feel better than drugs, and that was the love for his new daughter. And I'm not sure what exactly changed in Richard, but suddenly he wanted to be a better person for his daughter. And again, can we just end the story here?
Yeah, seriously. He has these moments of like an epiphany where he's like, I'm gonna do what right by my daughter. I'm gonna do right by my mother. And then it all goes to shit in just a couple days.
Yeah. Again, self-sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do think that the real reason Richard did so well in prison is because that no one really expected much of him. They thought, hey, he's a shitbag. That's the only thing you have to do all day is be a shitbag. Like, just wake up, eat, go work out, go back to your cell. Like, there's not a whole lot of expectations. And he had this very tight routine. And while he did loathe the guards who essentially controlled his every move, this way of living was also some kind of a relief because no one was going to judge him.
Yeah, this part of Speck's life has always interested me. Like, it's such a strange thought process, but I can see a place where you aren't responsible for anything and where you have no decisions to make. Like, it could possibly be comforting. Like, you don't even have to think about, oh, what am I going to make for dinner tonight? Like, somebody does that for you.
Well, also, while in prison, Richard had another inmate give him his infamous tattoo on his arm that says, quote, born to raise hell. It's like the douchiest thing you can get on your body up there next to it, like a tribal armband circa 1999.
Looking at you, Nick Lachey.
Also looking at 18-year-old Ed Hydock, but moving on.
You know what? I couldn't remember if you had one.
I have a tribal
arm. So 98. Like, oh my
shut
God.
Up. First of all, okay, one, shut it. Two, I had it. It's now it looks like a rose bush because I was like, this tribal armband's stupid. I'm going to have somebody do something to it. And all they could do was like put these. We're not getting into my tattoos. Anyway, he also had the name of his daughter, Robbie Lynn, tattooed on his other arm.
So are you picking up on this? This is like almost like an angel versus devil thing. Like
a little bit.
On the one arm, it's his desire to be a better person for his daughter. But then his other desire to raise hell.
Yeah.
It's so strange. And the fact that he did it on opposite arms, I'm like, was he thinking that? Probably not, because I don't think he's that bright.
Yeah, you wonder if that's what was going on in his head, too.
Yeah, he's definitely an interesting case study. But seriously, that tattoo is so lame.
Oh,
born to raise hell. You're
oh, my
so
God.
Cool.
It's like the sticker. Brenda has one on her scooter. It says born to ride. I'm like, babe, this thing tops out at like 40 miles an hour. Like, please take that off.
Well, hopefully she's careful. You know, scooter accidents can be very dangerous.
The silent killer. Anyway, January 2nd, 1965, Richard was paroled early after serving just 16 months. Oh. And this was due to good behavior while behind bars. And he even received commendations for being such a great prisoner.
That's insane.
I know. But when Richard came home, there were several changes.
And we know that Richard does not do well with changes, like
no.
Especially ones that he doesn't know are coming.
Right. Remember like that day he got, here's your new dad, here's your new city, here's
yeah.
your new house, here's your new name, here's your new everything.
Oh,
man. Well, prior to Richard being incarcerated, Carolyn had met and married a young man. And after they married, the new husband had moved into the Speck household. However, the couple had moved out and were just about to have a baby. So at home, it was only Richard and his mom at this point. And unsurprisingly, it took only a few days before Mary's overbearing micromanagement style left Richard feeling smothered and very angry.
Angrier than normal?
Angry, yes. Extra angry. And to be clear, Richard didn't seem to mind Carolyn's husband. That wasn't what it was about. He also felt very like inferior to him.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like he had this complex where any man that was bigger than him, like physically taller or bigger in stature or was more successful than him, was like out to get him. It's an ego thing.
It's wild how self-centered and self-important he is. Like, he's the type of person who just assumes everyone is talking about them and everyone is judging them. And it's like, nobody cares about you. Relax.
But you know what? You grow up with acne. You grow up wearing glasses. Everyone was judging him. So that probably never left childhood. He probably have just felt that his whole life.
Yeah. And I think because Carl singled him out of the other kids, mm-hmm. it was like the meanest to him. You know, it's mm-hmm. just so many things went wrong with Richard Speck.
100%. Well, by now, I'm sure you're wondering where Shirley and the baby are, too, because Richard certainly is.
Yeah.
And remember, Shirley had left the Speck home after she had Robbie Lynn. Well, in the meantime, Mary, Carolyn, and the husband had refused to give Richard any information on Shirley or the baby, which was probably for the best. But then Mom Mary comes in, and she could not lie to her baby boy. So she cracks under Richard's constant harassment, and she timidly tells him that Shirley had gotten her own place, and she was seriously dating a man who she planned to marry.
Oof.
So what do we know about Richard thus far?
He's a spoiled brat.
He is a spoiled brat, but he also gets angry at the drop of a hat. And in this case, Richard was calm. He was almost like relieved, I guess might be the way to put it. Like if Shirley was seeing some guy, it just proved Richard was right because she is a whore.
But like the only reason she's seeing someone else is because he was such an asshole and then he got arrested. Like he just refuses to take responsibility and accountability for anything.
It's a fact. Never learns.
It's wild.
Well, it's actually a great segue because he also never learns from his financial mistakes. So Richard did have a little money when he got out of prison, but as soon as he was on the outside, guess where that money went? To every bar in town, any bottle of liquor he could find. Although he did make one investment, a 17-inch carving knife.
Yikes.
Right. Well, in the days after he leaves prison, Richard was basically drinking 24/7, roaming the streets each and every night that he drank, and he got angrier and angrier about Shirley. This relief that he initially felt was now seething anger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how dare she turn him down for sex? How dare she keep his child from him? Like, he was beyond obsessive, and the anger was escalating steadily. Was it with every drink, he got more and more fired up.
Mm-hmm.
So one night, that anger boiled over, and he was, surprise, surprise, at a bar, being rude, being belligerent, trying to start trouble with anybody in sight. And eventually he leaves or he gets kicked out because it was like 2 a.m. So he's wandering the streets of Chicago completely wasted and suddenly sees a young woman getting it and either in or out of her car. She was interacting with her car somehow. And I'm going to read you a passage from the book that we've been referencing because the author really does a great job describing it. In his eyes, this random woman was a symbol of everything wrong with the world. Out late at night, on her own, to his mind, she was clearly a prostitute, one of the whores he was forever ranting about. He wanted to punish her. More than punishment, he wanted to strip her of beauty, hack away at the face that had made his breath catch when he first saw it. He wanted, above all else, to break the power that women had over him. End quote.
Oh, that is so intense.
Skeevy. Like,
when I read that, I just was like, he is drowning in his own toxicity. Like,
yes.
His anger is just driving every move he makes. It's like his anger about things that aren't even happening drives him to be so wild.
Yeah. What is that called when you imagine scenarios in your head that don't exist? Like the people that worry about, I call, when Brenda does it, I call it pre-worrying. She's worrying about something that's going to happen 4 days from now that you have no idea what's going to happen. Why are you pre-worrying about it?
But like, instead of worrying about this, he gets angry about it.
Yeah,
like,
there's got to be a term for that.
Yeah, he sees people laughing and he just automatically expects they're laughing at him and he's going to get angry and teach them a lesson. And it's like, they were laughing because they told a joke. Like,
yeah, like write in and tell us the term, guys. I can't think of that word. Let us know what that word is.
Yeah.
Well, thank God this girl must have seen him or felt his presence because she screams super loud, like loud enough to wake up the whole neighborhood. He just takes off. And because he is the world's worst criminal, a cop catches him a few minutes later. And the parole board did not love this for him. So after 1 week of being on the outside, he goes right back to Huntsville prison. And back to your like justice system is broken comment. So stick with me here. So Richard was charged and convicted of aggravated assault, for which he got 16 months. So then they added 6 months on top because of for trying to stab someone against the rules of parole, obviously.
Oh, they don't like that?
No, they're not fans of that. So Richard goes to prison. 6 months into his sentence, he's released. And apparently there was an error made on his paperwork because whoever let him out didn't realize that he had the original 16 months added. It was like just 6 months.
That's insane. So he's got these two sentences and they see that he's at the end of one and they're like, all right, have a good one. Oh.
Well, of course, Richard's not going to be like, oh, hold on, guys. Don't let me go yet. Right. So he says goodbye and he hops a bus back to his mama's house in Dallas. And Richard has a choice now. He can either step up, straighten out, or he could fall back into his old habits. And I think we know which path he's going to choose. So Richard found employment pretty quickly after being released. He was driving delivery trucks for Patterson Meat Company. So, okay, he's got this great job, except that while he was out making deliveries, he would swing by local bars on his route, have a few drinks, and then go back out on the road to make some more deliveries.
So he's drinking and driving on his delivery route. That
he is.
Seems like a really good decision. I'm sure nothing will go wrong.
No, not at all. Well, he began frequenting a bar named Ginny's Lounge. Richard just liked the vibe of this bar. And then he goes in to meet the owner, the woman named Ginny, and he became kind of entranced by her right away. So Ginny was a former pro wrestler. It's giving me Killer Sally vibes when I read
that. Yeah.
Well, but he was in awe of her strength. And the two began some like kind of light flirting, we'll put it.
But you know what, though? I'm pretty sure that she was only flirting with him for a good tip. Like, that's how you make money as a bartender.
As bartenders do. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what her real feelings were toward Richard, but if she was interested, it would be totally fine because she was divorced. She had a few younger kids that she was supporting. And bottom line is, regardless of her interest in him, Richard soon became completely smitten. Smitten might be not the right word. Obsessed, I think, would be closer to what we're talking about. But soon enough, he was blowing off work to spend days drinking at Ginny's. Oh, and by the way, within 3 months of Richard working as a delivery driver, 6 car accidents.
That sounds like my record, but that's not it because of drinking. It's
neither here nor there.
Because I can't drive. Go on. Right.
So this part is wild, and it really does just go to show that there is a very strange relationship going on between Richard and his mother. So one morning when he leaves the house early, Mary follows him, and she follows him all the way to his favorite watering hole with his favorite bartender, Ginny. So Mary was upset to see that Richard was yet again drinking his life away, but she somehow crept into the bar without drawing any attention to herself. And she began watching Richard, kind of a fly on the wall, and how he was interacting with the women behind the bar. And Mary could tell that Richard was completely taken by Ginny. So the wheels start turning in Mary's head, and she realizes that this barmaid might actually be good for Richard. Like, she could hold her own against him, and she was considering playing Cupid.
Or I feel like Mary's probably thinking, oh my God, this is my last shot to get this lazy ass out of my house.
There's that, which, too.
Which is wild, because just like he feels so conflicted about his mother, it's almost like she feels conflicted about him, because like,
yeah,
now she wants him out. But ma'am, you spent his whole life trying to smother him and keep him at home. Like,
I know.
It's so strange. Wild.
It is. And we do a whole other episode on like the dynamics of the Speck family, but I don't want to get too far off track, because Mary begins her little matchmaking scheme and she suggests that Richard offer to babysit Ginny's kids. Like, get your foot in the door. And this is kind of messed up, but it seems like Mary's thought process was that if Ginny saw Richard as his father figure to her kids, that she would also see him as a possible romantic partner.
I get her thinking.
Yeah, totally. And it worked. Richard began babysitting for Ginny's kids, and then Richard and Ginny started hooking up. He begins staying with her, and she lived next to or above the bar. So, I mean, he would go to the bar, and she was right there. So it was an easy one-stop shop. And things are okay for Richard right now. However, it seems like Richard thought they were a couple. And that's where the wheels kind of fall off, because we don't really know what Ginny thought.
I feel like she's like, all right, I got childcare. I got a friend with benefits. Like,
yeah,
I'm good.
Exactly.
And yeah. And I feel like she's also thinking like couple beers, those beer goggles can hide that ugly mug. Because
it's very true.
Richard Speck is rough.
Yeah, he is. Well, and at some point, Richard was actually living with Ginny. And this was sometime in January of 1966. Shirley filed for divorce. And Richard surprisingly didn't act out, at least right away. Let his anger fester, which we know how healthy that is. And it eventually had bubbled over, and he began spending more time at the bar, stalking Ginny, watching her. He sat and just looked at her talking to other men at the bar.
Which is most likely just innocent talking. Like, that's literally her job.
Yeah, you're a bartender.
Yeah. But he's, like, internalizing this along with his anger at Shirley. And it's just adding to his belief that all women are whores because Ginny's supposed to be with him, but she's talking to these men.
Right. And if Ginny said, we're, like, I don't know what he, again, what did he think their relationship was? Because if it's not what he thought, then all of those evil thoughts from childhood and from a young age that all women are whores creeps right back in.
But I feel like even if they were together and they both felt that way, she was just talking to her customers. Like, that's literally part of the job.
Exactly. When it's his ego.
Mm-hmm.
Very fragile.
Yeah.
Well, one night when he should have been watching the kids, Richard went down to the bar and he saw an interaction between Ginny and a certain bar patron. And apparently she was handing this guy his change. But Richard, in his, like, twisted, jealous head, felt that the man's hand lingered on Ginny's for too long as they were passing. It's like weird stuff, right? And he just lost his mind. So Richard lunges at the man and begins beating him and then takes out this 17-inch knife that he bought and begins stabbing the guy. And the fight spills over outside as the innocent man's friends are trying to, like, drag him away. And suddenly Richard hears sirens, and this is when kind of like all this quote-unquote blind fury came out. So Richard stumbles back in the bar, literally ready to kill whoever called the police, when he sees Ginny looking at him with pure hatred. And he stood next to her. She was, like, next to the phone. And that's when he realized that she called the police on him. So Richard was arrested, but Mary, who couldn't stop meddling for 5 seconds, shows up with a lawyer. And between the lawyer and Mary pestering and badgering the DA, they agreed to lessen the charge against Richard. And remember, he had slipped out of prison due to that pesky paperwork error not that long ago.
Yeah, so, like, if this were me, knowing I got off so easy, like, I would have taken any sweet deal that they offered.
Hell, but, yeah.
Like, before someone recognized the mistake.
Yes, dumbass. Not you, him.
No, but, him, yeah.
Well, yeah, even though he almost kills this man, the DA agrees to drop the aggravated assault charge. Again, he slips through the cracks. Like, all he had to do was plead guilty to creating a public disturbance and pay a $10 fine. And again, 1966, so don't think $10. Like, this was decades ago. But Richard refuses to pay the $10, so he ends up getting thrown in a local jail for 3 days.
Which isn't really, like, a punishment, because we know he likes prison.
Yeah, and it's 3 days. Like, oh no.
Yeah, and it's local jail, like, not prison.
Yes. Well, yeah, it wasn't a hardship compared to state prison. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Richard was released, he was forced to go back to his mother's home. And as soon as he returned, his mother began hounding him to get a job, which is completely understandable.
Yeah.
He's in his early 20s at this point, and she wanted him to get his life together. But Richard didn't see it like that. He believed his mother wanted him to get a job so that he would move out and she would go back to being a whore with any man she could find. And these are Richard's words, not mine.
Yeah, no, he's so twisted. Like, he's like, he doesn't see it like, my mom wants me to get it together and get a job and be a contributing member of society. He sees it like, oh, she just wants me out of the house so she can start effing dudes left and right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't want to say crazy, that's not a good word, but he's just
warped.
His mentality is so warped.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this, his reputation precedes him because every respectable employer in town knew that they could not trust Richard to be a long-term employee. Like, he would work as much as possible. This is what he would do. He would work as much as possible, taking overtime from everybody else at the company until his first payday. And then he would take that money and drown himself in a bottle of booze. And then the money was gone and he would never go back to that job. So, of course, you can't save money if you're drinking it all away. So Richard does what Richard does, and he decides to make some quick cash. He robs a convenience store, as he'd done in the past, and he got away with cartons of cigarettes and he would sell them on the street. And he actually made a ton of money in just one night by doing this. But by the time he sobered up, he realized that anyone who, like, he sold these things to could ID him. Like, he knew it was just a matter of time before he got caught. So he hid out in abandoned homes, also as he's done his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But a day or so later, he gathers up the courage to go back to his mom's house, where a hysterical Mary tells him there's a warrant out for his arrest. And this time she's not going to protect him. The whole town knew what he had done, and the police were looking for him. So Mary knew that with Richard's long criminal rap sheet that he wasn't going to get off easy this time. And he would most certainly be doing hard time in not local jail, not state prison, but federal prison, club fed.
Yeah, when you factor in everything he's done and the forgery and robbing for cigarettes and, you know, all these things that he's done, stabbing the guy, like you add this all up, I can't protect you this time.
Well, within minutes of Richard arriving home, Carolyn shows up and whisks him away to the closest bus station, gave him some cash, gave him a kiss goodbye, and waved as Richard got on the bus, heading away from Dallas. Richard's oldest sister, Martha, and her husband, Gene, were waiting for Richard when he got off the bus in Illinois. And it was clear the second that Richard arrived that he was not exactly welcomed by Gene.
I mean, can you blame him, though? Like, if I'm Gene, I'm thinking, here comes my deadbeat brother-in-law. The guy's got no job, no money. He's got an arrest record longer than my arm.
Yeah, it's like, can't wait to have him in my house.
Exactly. And remember, Martha is so much older than Richard. And like, she and Gene have teenage daughters at this point. So Richard is
moving in. And
they're
going to bring this guy.
Exactly. Yeah. And Richard's not that much older than the teenage daughters.
No, I totally get it. Absolutely. When, and all of that was true and exactly how Gene felt about Richard. And he definitely didn't like the way Richard looked at his daughters. Martha, Gene, and Richard quickly made a plan to help get Richard back on his feet and, more importantly, out of Gene's house. So Richard hops yet another bus back to his hometown of Monmouth, Illinois, where he met his brother, Howard. And Howard was now the oldest brother, because remember, the I think it was Robert was killed in that accident. Yeah. So Howard was well-known and well-respected in this small town, and he was able to pull some strings and get Richard a sort of a carpentry job, but let's be honest, Howard was nervous. We all know how Richard can be, but shockingly, within just a few days, Howard was hearing like rave reviews from Richard's boss, saying how great he was. He was a hard worker. And Howard was like, this is great. And it went on for a few weeks, but if we've learned anything about Richard by now, it's that he cannot stay on the straight and narrow, so enter alcohol.
Yeah.
When Richard first arrived, he was staying with Howard, which, just like the job, worked out for a little while. But soon, Richard was stumbling and drunk at all hours of the night, sometimes early in the next morning. And I think at this point, Howard wanted his little brother gone. But he felt like he had this, like, loyalty to abide by. And luckily, Richard, who didn't like having to answer to anyone, told Howard he found a place to live. What he didn't tell Howard was a seedy motel not that far away. But at least he was out of Howard's hair for a little bit.
Yeah.
So now we're at March 25th, 1966, and Richard is in his new place, which just so happened to be a short walk to several of his favorite taverns. And with money in his pocket and no supervision, it wasn't long before Richard was back to drinking all night, picking fights with anyone. So one weekend night, Richard is at the bar and yet again took some lighthearted ribbing seriously and began basically beating the crap out of some guy in the bar's bathroom. Richard was dragged away from the man pretty quickly, but it didn't really matter because the man went straight to police and pointed the finger at Richard, who promptly picked Richard up and threw him in jail. And he wasn't released until late the afternoon on Monday, meaning he was a no-call, no-show at his job. And we know this is Richard's pattern. It's him, his MO when it comes to employment. Like, get a job, do a good job, start drinking, screw it up, rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
So that Monday afternoon, he goes to his bosses begging for forgiveness. And while he was not fired, he was definitely given a harsh verbal warning, and meaning like one more infraction, you're getting your pink slip. Goodbye.
Yeah.
So Richard did try to keep himself busy, but he continued getting into these little tiffs with his coworkers, which I feel like he was the epitome of like the guy who could dish it out but couldn't take it. I guess is the best way to describe stuff.
Yeah, I feel like his report cards, other than saying you got a zero again, but they would also say does not work well with others.
You're absolutely right. Well, that's how Richard's bosses felt, too. And the next project he was assigned to was to build this new pig pen behind a local bar called Frank's Place. And Richard was tasked with doing the entire project by himself. So alone with his own devices. But Richard does now have a job, a place to live, and he's got some cash. What's missing, you ask? A woman. And Richard was having zero luck on the dating scene. Like, no woman would give him the time of day, especially because misogyny permeated from him, which we've heard this entire hour. Shirley was a dumb whore for leaving him. Ginny was a dumb whore for turning him into the police. His mom was a dumb whore for doing what she was doing. It wasn't his doing. It was theirs. Everything was their fault.
Always.
Well, on the night of April 2nd, Richard was drinking heavily and began feeling sorry for himself because he hadn't had sex in ages. And because he had just found out from his mother that Shirley's petition for divorce had been granted, he's having a pretty intense pity party, which very quickly morphs into seething anger. And yet again, this anger was misdirected toward women as a whole, as he does. So in this drunken stupor, he decides to break into the home of 60-something-year-old divorcee Virgil Harris. And this poor woman is financially struggling already, and she had spent the whole night babysitting for a neighbor, making less than $3. That's what she made. Though she returned to this very dark home only to come face-to-face with Richard, and he proceeded to rape this woman and make off with her babysitting money and her radio. So Virgil was understandably upset, but mostly confused, like, what the hell just happened here? So she calls the police and tells them about it, and she also adds that her attacker was incredibly soft-spoken and kind of polite, which
that's
I don't get.
So weird. Like, in the book, it talks about this, and it's kind of like she's so confused because this man just forced himself upon her in one of the most horrific and evil things one human can do to another. But then he's speaking so nicely to her and saying please and thank you, which, like,
very weird.
And I feel like this just goes back to his constant conflicting conscience with everything. It's it makes you wonder if he does want to be good, or maybe a part of him wants to be good, but then he just can't handle it.
Yeah, it's almost like every time he's handed something on a silver platter, he smacks the hand that feeds him.
Yeah.
Every time. Well, unfortunately, this attack on Virgil did not satisfy Richard by any means. So she didn't fight nearly enough for his, like, sick satisfaction.
Ugh.
Like, he wanted more, and only a week later, he would commit his first murder. And this murder is rarely discussed when it comes to Richard Speck because the later murders are the ones that will make him famous, but we really wanted to make sure we mention this, as we do. Like, no victim goes unnoticed here.
Yeah, I actually didn't really know too much about this murder, and I feel like this woman does not get the recognition. Not that you want to be recognized as a victim, but
no.
We need to say her name.
Yep, I completely agree. And I do want to point out that technically this murder is unsolved, at least on paper. So the next part is coming from the book that we've been referencing, The Townhouse Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about a week after the assault and robbery of Virgil Harris, and in a shock to no one, Richard is out at a bar drinking.
No way.
Yeah, I know. He was at Frank's place, the one we were mentioning, the one where he had the pig pen built out back.
Mm-hmm.
So he was working to numb these headaches and getting sloshed when one of the regular bartenders, a woman named Mary, she makes a good-natured joke about Richard. And we don't know what the joke was, but it was described in the book as, quote, a friendly joke at his expense, end quote.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we know how that goes. Well, Richard is drunk, he's angry, and now a woman, who he believed was beneath him, had the audacity to make a joke about him in front of other men.
Oh, boy.
Yes, and we already know how paranoid Richard is about people laughing at him, that he couldn't take it anymore, and Richard storms out of the bar. And it was late, it was pitch black outside, and he's staring at the pigs in this pen that he had just built, just like stewing with anger when he hears this woman calling his name. It was the bartender who dared to make a joke about him. Her name was Mary Kay Pierce, who, by the way, is Frank's sister-in-law.
Oh, Frank, who owned the bar.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So she begins to apologize, which Richard takes her as being condescending and just basically attempting to pacify him.
Oh my God.
So as he stood there staring at this woman, anger washed over him. And the next thing he knew, he throws a vicious right punch into Mary's stomach so violently that she flies into the air. And when he pulls his fist back, Mary crumples to the ground. And she's trying to, like, catch her breath. I assume he really knocked the wind out of her, but she's gurgling her own blood. And Richard grabs her and drags her further into the pig pen, where he attempts to rape her. But Mary, even though she knew at this point that she was dying, she fought with every ounce of energy she had left.
Yeah.
And suddenly Richard hears a noise from the bar, like he knew he'd be caught easily. So he takes off, leaving Mary to die there alone in this disgusting pig pen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it would be determined that that one punch, he had ruptured Mary's liver, killing her.
Jesus, one punch.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it was a calculated punch. He may have just flipped and punched, like, as hard as he could, every ounce of energy into that jab. I don't know. But what I do know is that's where we're going to end today's part one hour one of Richard Speck, because what we're going to get into next week is crazy. Like, this was just the beginning.
Yeah, next week is going to be a little bit more about Richard, but mostly more about his victims. And
yes,
we had some help by our wonderful research assistant, Shannon. And it's very important to Shannon and to us to get as much information as we can about the victim. And she went deep into these women. And I think it's great because, again, kind of like with Mary Kay Pierce, these women become an afterthought almost to the Richard Speck murders.
Yeah.
And it's like, it shouldn't be about him. So we are going to find out some really cool information about each one of those young women.
Yeah, we are. And you know what? Tobias or not, I'm still excited we got to do this story. I don't like the fact that we just took December and made it another serial killer month, especially with two-part episodes. But you know what? I mean, both of these episodes are really thorough and really, I think, well done. So, I mean, it's worth it, even if we don't get to interview who we wanted to.
Yeah. So we thank you guys for listening. I mean, do we have anything fun to talk about this week?
Oh, we sent, speaking of Shannon, I sent her other replacement. Maybe you guys saw on social media, I sent her other letter, her stickers. I got her, got them in the mail.
I think you guys are putting way too much faith into USPS. Sorry, I am not a big fan.
But I'm not going to FedEx stickers. Like, I'm just going to throw them in the mail.
That's true. But they didn't get there the first time.
They got to everybody else except Shannon. I suspect some funny business. I think she just wants more stickers.
Oh, I thought you were blaming me. I was like, I sent them, I swear.
No, no, no. I think she's like, I didn't get them. Send more stickers.
Oh, maybe she's like wallpapering her house with them.
Maybe. That'd be creepy. That'd be a real serial killer move.
I'm going to start doing that. Wallpaper my bedroom and murder unscripted stickers.
I hope someone finds your body there. They're like,
I know. They're like, what the hell?
What is happening here? Yeah, that's about it as far as things are. I just got back from Colorado.
Yeah, how was that?
Good. Really good. Amazing. Like, I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to go to work. I didn't want to do anything other than just be outside in the great outdoors in one
cold?
Of the most beautiful places on. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like here. Like here.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't too bad. Yeah. It
wasn't too bad. One day dropped down to, I think, 18. But the other, there was a day in the 60s. I mean, it was like Pennsylvania, pretty much.
That's wild. Well, good. And welcome back.
Well, thank you. And just a little behind the scenes. So television companies, they don't, you don't get time off. Like, I'm a contracted employee. I'm currently right now employed for season two of this particular series, which I cannot talk about. But what I can say is that every company I've ever worked for is always closed. It's called down or dark. You're dark Thanksgiving week and 2 weeks around the holidays. It's usually Christmas and New Year. So it does mean that you don't get paid, but it also is like your scheduled break where you can do whatever you want. So it does kind of suck that that's the only time that you can take vacations, or, I mean, you can take them anytime, you just don't get paid. So why not take them on a week you're already not getting paid?
Well, in all fairness, I've worked every holiday for the last 20 years, so it's fine. But I do get paid for them, so.
You get paid for them, right? That's the difference. Yes. Yeah, this is like you're told you're not working that week. So yeah, that's down or dark.
I just thought it meant you were in like a dark place in your mind. That's what I say when I'm feeling. I have
when
a
you
dark
don't get a paycheck.
Week.
Yeah. Yeah. When they say we're not going to send your paycheck this week. Yeah, that's a dark place.
That is a dark place. Well, I mean, we're making so much money from Murder Unscripted, so it's fine. Totally fine.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real big hit when all you're doing is sending out replacement stickers to people claiming they didn't get their first one signed.
Yeah. Shannon blew our budget for this month with all those stamps.
Our sticker budget. We are hemorrhaging money.
You had to buy envelopes. Come on, guys.
Thanks a lot, Shannon. Crippling us financially.
Shannon, you give her so much Shannon, I love you. This is all him, not me.
I bet you Shannon didn't tune in going, man, I think I was catching strays today.
Always getting it. Damn.
Oh, man.
Well,
anyway.
On that note, I hope you'll tune in next week to hear more about Shannon's downfalls.
Who else are we going to trash? Who are we going to trash next week?
Oh, I'll make you. I got tons of people. I can make a list.
Perfect.
Oh, my God. Well, if you guys can think of that word that Ed and I couldn't think of earlier, when you're like angry for something that didn't happen or might happen, but you're not sure yet, but you're angry about it.
Yeah.
You can hit us up on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can hit us up on any of our socials. We are on Blue Sky, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Reddit, all of the above at Murder Unscripted. We hope everybody has a good week, and we will talk to you next week for part two of Richard Speck. But until then, stay safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they don't. And this guy was like a part-time pervert. He was like, what day of the week is it? Do I want to be a pervert today? I mean, I don't know what part two is going to bring, but...
Part two, he's a bad pervert.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll learn about that next week.
Bye.
See ya.